This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, this is Resource Centre. I'm Maya Tan. We live in a fractured world. Leaders today, whether in corporations or associations, non-profits or nations, face massive, messy, multidimensional problems. No one person or group can possibly solve them. They require the broadest possible cooperation. But according to Harvard scholar Dr. Dean Williams, our leadership models are still essentially tribal, individuals with formal authority leading in the interest of their own group. He's authored a book entitled Leadership for a Fractured World, How to Cross Boundaries, Build Bridges and Lead Change. I have Dr. Dean Williams on the line with me. Welcome.
Yes, good to talk with you, Maya. Thank you.
So first of all, could you explain why the world is fractured, as you say?
Yeah, it's we're well into the 21st century, but already we're seeing these fractures all over the world, not to say that the world is in a constant state of fracture. There's some wonderful things that are working very well. But there can be fractures that are as wide as the Grand Canyon, and also hairline fractures, divisions that get triggered given some sudden or spontaneous event in the world. Mm-hmm. And so all is not well, because even though we are connected through information technology and new media, we are still fundamentally tribal, and our approach to solving problems is tribal. In other words, we try to solve problems in our own little groups, but the problems we face today are interdependent problems. And when we cannot address these interdependent problems, these fractures either get triggered or they are widened.
So this is true for organizations as well as business ecosystems.
Yeah, no doubt about it. All organizations face this kind of challenge. Mm-hmm. And whether you're a local business operating at the local level or you are a global business that operate in multiple countries, these global forces and dynamics are impacting you in all sorts of unpredictable ways. The stress and the strain of trying to do business, to cross these boundaries and borders in order to mobilize diverse groups to tackle these shared challenges, is a very difficult task for anyone. As I said, whether it's a local business operating domestically, it's still impacted by global forces and must be able to respond to these challenges effectively and efficiently if it's to get anything done.
Right. Why do you think we automatically adopt this tribal model? And do leaders have a hand in causing these fractures within organizations?
Yeah, I think it's instinctual. It's perhaps in our genetic predisposition that essentially we're tribal. Mm-hmm. You know, I began as a doctoral student spending time studying tribal groups in Borneo, of all places. So I've spent a lot of my time, my career, you know, working in the university, but also consulting to business and working with governments. Studying tribal groups, you learn so much about human nature. So whether it's a tribe in the jungles of Borneo, whether it's a tribe on Wall Street, essentially it's a group of people coming together with shared values trying to get something done. So the tribal instinct kind of reinforces a particular identity, a boundary, and we're inclined to exaggerate the value and the importance of our own group at the expense of others, trivializing or demeaning other groups. So this instinct is common. It's common in business. And therefore, in business, we commonly see the silo mentality emerge, cultures where you have distinct groups refusing or unwillingly, you know, working with other groups to get things done. And so people kind of retreat to their enclave, and they value their particular group at the expense of doing the collective problem-solving and creative work that's necessary to generate any kind of breakthrough that adds value to the collective.
Right. That's really fascinating that you've studied tribes and that there are so many similarities to Western societies as well. It's in Wall Street, as you say. Are there any examples of cross-cultural breakdown that we're trying to fix around the world?
Well, if, you know, the most obvious one, I think, would be the global economy. Mm. And in 2008, 2009, we had a global financial crisis. Now, that's huge, and it's an overwhelming challenge. But I had the opportunity to sit down and interview for my book, Gordon Brown, the former Prime Minister of the UK and the former Chancellor of the Exchequer. And he could see or anticipate this problem because he knew that it's kind of an interconnected global economy, and also that Europe held over half of the subprime debt, this kind of toxic product that it had bought from the United States. And so any breakdown in this product would ultimately poison the European economy as well. So he anticipated it, but he could do little to bring resolution to it because of the difficulty in crossing these borders and boundaries to mobilize these diverse groups to tackle this shared problem. And he told me that was the biggest regret of his time as a prime minister and certainly as the chancellor. And also as a politician, you're inclined to go after the low-hanging fruit, you know, the easy fruit, rather than to deal with these bigger, more complex challenges. So obviously, Wall Street included, once again, these tribal institutions kind of thinking in terms of their own business interests at the expense of the larger economic challenges ahead of the in the United States, Alan Greenspan, the head of the Federal Reserve, you know, after the fact, when he was no longer in the job, said, you know, my own ideology got in the way. I guess I thought that these businesses, these big banks, would at least would have the capacity to pull back. I overestimated the power of greed to kind of work for the interests of the collective. So a lot of people are apologizing after the fact and realize that their own kind of tribal orientation impeded their capacity to address these challenges. So it's not only the global economic system, you're talking also dealing with terrorism. These are interdependent challenges. Climate change, once again, it's an interdependent challenge. There are so many issues and challenges. And if you're a business, you know, how do you create a business, a global business, that takes advantage of the diversity of not only your workforce, but your customer and suppliers, so that it actually generates significantly greater value for the company? These are huge challenges. And you're noticing some companies, for example, in Silicon Valley, they're actually hiring anthropologists to help them understand, diagnose, appreciate the complexity of these challenges, and to shift the internal cultures of their organizations to respond to these global demands for which the tribal impulse is, I guess, insufficient or seriously deficient as a way for addressing these challenges.
Well, because it's so deeply rooted in us, are there any positives when it comes to the tribal model?
The tribal model, yes, there's a lot of value to that. It generates a sense of identity, community, and for good reason we are tribal in nature. It allows a group of people to come together to solve kind of local or routine problems and provide a holding environment, like a container, of kind of predictable activity. So it's wonderful from that point of view. It allows us to engage in activity that generates value for a small group, but it, or a community, but its flaws or its deficiencies pertain to dealing with interdependent challenges. And given that we live in the age of globalization, so many of these challenges are interdependent. They are multidimensional. So the tribal orientation is a wonderful for a sense of community. Tribes, by nature, they have kind of boundary keepers who manage the boundaries to keep certain people in and to keep others out and to reinforce certain practices, ceremony, ritual, and what have you. But sometimes those activities become maladaptive, ineffective, even seriously kind of impeding problem solving to deal with the more complex challenges that we face today. So there are strengths and weaknesses to the tribal impulse. And the challenge of leadership is to be able to identify the strengths and to play off those, but also to see the flaws and deficiencies and to bust some of these impeding practices and boundaries so that the institution, the company, or the government or the community can better respond to these larger interdependent challenges.
I'm speaking to Dr. Dean Williams, author of the book Leadership for a Fractured World, How to Cross Boundaries, Build Bridges, and Lead Change. When we come back, we'll be taking a look at the three different areas in his book on Resource Center, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon, this is Maya Tan and you're listening to Resource Center. I'm speaking to Dr. Dean Williams, the author of the book Leadership for a Fractured World, How to Cross Boundaries, Build Bridges and Lead Change. So let's talk about crossing boundaries first. What are the common challenges that leaders face and any case examples you may have?
Yeah, well, the tribal impulse leads us to try to solve our problems within our boundaries. But when faced with interdependent challenges, you've got to cross boundaries. That means leaving the safety and confines of your own group and interacting with other groups that are often very diverse and different from your own. And crossing boundaries doesn't come easy for us. You know, we can do it as a tourist and be entertained by the others, but to engage other groups in problem solving is a little bit more complex, even troubling at times, because the other group may not recognize you. So if you're trying to exercise leadership, you cross over and interact with another group, they don't give you much authorization to actively engage them. They don't even have to recognize your authority or your leadership. Your own group might be a little bit dismayed that you're leaving them and going out to engage other groups. They may be a little bit suspicious of what agreements that you are trying to make. And so your own group and the other group can make it very difficult here. Therefore, we're inclined to cross these borders and boundaries and to engage others because we're in, volatile terrain and we feel a little bit vulnerable in that space. But this is probably the most critical leadership capacity that is needed today by change agents and leaders, this capacity for crossing boundaries and engaging diverse factions in the work of problem solving and change.
Mm-hmm. Well, in your book, do you outline some strategies that leaders can take?
Absolutely. For one, you need to be more diagnostic and know when you're crossing these boundaries what you're getting into. So by being diagnostic, I mean try to understand the story of the other group. What's their narrative? How do they interpret the problem? How do they interpret their boundaries and their identity? And all groups have a story about who they are, what their role is, what they're trying to accomplish, what their aspirations are, how they view you and your group. So it's important to be diagnostic, to appreciate what is going on the other side. What's their story? So you go in with this curiosity, this spirit of listening and understanding rather than judging or imposing or demanding. Very critical. So you go in quietly and slowly in the spirit of learning. Also, you've got to work with your own group to help them understand and appreciate why these boundaries need to be crossed. What's the nature of this shared challenge that we face? And so in crossing boundaries, you're not trying to get the other groups to do what you want them to do. You're going with the spirit of understanding and learning and discovery so that you can generate more useful, accurate, reliable information that can be included in the problem solving or the creative process. And also you want to be aware that when you cross boundaries, others will perceive you as being somewhat ugly. By ugly, I mean, I take that term from an old book written in the late 1950s called The Ugly American. Mm-hmm. And the ugly individual is the individual who's insufficiently inattentive to how people perceive them and their activities. And so therefore they're inclined to be judgmental or imposing. And the other group therefore attributes to them this ugliness. You're failing to be sensitive to our particular concerns or needs, and you're aggrandizing your own tribe's values at the expense of other groups. So, managing your ugliness. As you mobilize or work with diverse groups, yes, certainly you'll be perceived to some degree as ugly because you're challenging them. Mm-hmm. And I look at leadership as being fundamentally a challenging activity. You're trying to get people to face tough realities that they don't want to face or they're having difficulty in facing. So you're putting a problematic reality in front of people and saying, we have to do something about that. And so these diverse groups all have something to say about that. And our challenge is to sustain attention on the problem long enough so some learning and discoveries can be made that can bring the resolution of the problem to completion at a faster rate than simply ignoring it or leaving one tribe to do all the work.
Right. And then the next step, of course, is sort of strengthening and developing a bigger bond. And that's what you mean by building bridges, would you say?
Yes, the building bridges is a critical aspect of it. There's two components to that. One is building the quality of the relationship. So it's a strong bond that allows for shared problem solving. But often with groups where we are a mystery to one another, like ships passing in the night, Or perhaps there has been conflict in the past, and these conflicts have been unresolved. And for some groups and some communities and societies, these conflicts, you know, go back hundreds of years, if not thousands of years. Mm. They're still alive in the present, and their identity is informed by these conflicts and crises and battles of the past. So to move forward, you have to bring these conflicts to resolution, to completion. So building bridges often requires healing wounds, reinterpreting past events, reinterpreting relationships in the present, generating shared aspirations on behalf of the future. That's tough and difficult work, and often very painful work, and requires tremendous kind of capacity to stick with it over time, because it's not only is a mutual learning process and a discovery process going on, there's an adaptive process. An adaptive process is there's a modification of mindset and values and habits and practices that allow two groups not simply to coexist, but to work together cooperatively on behalf of a shared future. So building bridges is very critical work. In organizations, it has to be done. There's these fractures that divide groups, and when you fail to address the reasons these fractures exist and to reduce the mystery or the misunderstanding, the fractures only widen. So you have to take on these challenges. And an example I give in the book is Nelson Mandela in 1994, the Rugby World Cup, where he walked out onto the field. He's been president of the country for only 1 year. Mm-hmm. And then Rugby World Cup, you know, probably 99% of the people who are attending in that stadium are white South Africans who are very suspicious and distrustful of Nelson Mandela. And he has to get them on board to build this country. So what does he do? He walks out onto the field wearing the uniform of the Springboks with the number of the captain on the back of his jersey and shakes hands with each of the team members and basically sending a signal to everyone. We're all on the same team, black and white, on behalf of creating a new South Africa.
Wow, that's beautiful.
Yeah, it's a beautiful
really
story.
Powerful.
Yeah, the captain of the team, very powerful. Yeah, the captain said, you know, he was had to bite his lip to keep himself from crying because he'd always viewed Mandela as a terrorist. And here's this man out on the field wearing his uniform with his number. And the two became great buddies after that. And the captain of the team, Francois Pina, asked Nelson Mandela to be the godfather to his children. So it was a turning point. That's a bridge-building opportunity. And perhaps it's a little bit dramatic for many people, but that's the kind of mindset and approach that is needed in institutions and community. And it takes people with a big heart and a big vision to be able to do that kind of work.
Would it help then to sort of develop a company culture with an attitude of sensitivity and cross-cultural awareness, that kind of thing?
Yes.
Very, and how do you do that?
Important. You know, in the book, as I look at the boundary work of leadership, so if we look at we're tribal in nature and so therefore the boundary confines us, I talk about the importance of crossing boundaries, as we've discussed, and building bridges. But there's another two aspects to the boundary work. One is busting boundaries, and the other is transcending boundaries. Hmm. Busting boundaries is breaking up the impeding practices and silos that exist in order to expose ourselves to the wider world, because all groups kind of persist in doing things that are counterproductive over time. They may have been very productive and appropriate at a given time, but then the larger world changes. So you've got to bust up these habitual behaviors. Very critical. And the transcending boundaries is like moving beyond the boundary, moving out into the great unknown in a voyage of discovery and learning. And transcending boundaries, in many ways, one aspect of it that's really important for business in that spirit of adventure, kind of creative exploration, is to harness the power of diversity, diverse voices. Diversity can be a strength to any community, any organization, and so an organizational culture should encourage and promote diversity. And by that I mean bringing diverse perspectives into the problem-solving mix that allows for greater creativity and insight into problems that you haven't considered. Whether it's gender diversity, whether it's race or ethnic diversity or age diversity or professional diversity. Now, I teach in a university, in a very renowned university, but all universities struggle with this. You know, the economists kind of do their own thing and dig deep, exploring a particular problem from a particular theoretical frame. The social scientists do likewise. The real scientists do likewise. And the historians do likewise. And so difficult to get people to come together to share their theoretical perspectives, to be open to the theoretical perspectives of others, and to work together collaboratively to illuminate a particular problem that allows for greater insight and understanding. So organizations have to do this. And so the leadership challenge is to harness that power of diversity to manage the inherent conflicts as these cultures and tribes bang up against one another, but to use that energy to create the to generate the creative process that can add extraordinary benefit to any organization. Apple have done this. Steve Jobs understood the power of diversity and conflict in generating more innovation in the context of Apple and the other companies that he was involved with. So certainly Silicon Valley, by virtue of there being so many global companies there, or at least international companies trying to be global companies, understand the importance of diversity.
Mm-hmm. How do you begin that kind of culture? Does it begin at the hiring process from day one?
Yes, hiring is obviously very important, but the quality of leadership at the top is critical. If you are not walking the talk and then kind of embodying these values of crossing boundaries, busting boundaries, building bridges, transcending boundaries, if you yourself are not kind of carrying that mantle and promoting that mantle, and if you don't have that global mindset yourself, it's going to be very difficult to instill that kind of a culture in the organization.
Right.
So it begins at the top. And then, yes, and it does begin with hiring the most, you know, the appropriate people, but you might be a real change agent in some way, but then, and you're hired for your change agent capacities. But if you hit the culture that has a very strong culture, which means it's a strong kind of tribal impulse is alive and well in that institution, you may be banging your head against these boundaries. So you've got to build a network of partnerships if you're able to modify these cultures. So you need this group of change agents, which is absolutely critical, or else you're going to become very frustrated in that kind of work. Mm-hmm. But every organization I've been in, you will find committed people who do want to make some changes. You'll also find those many people who are frustrated or apathetic or have just kind of given up because they've tried so hard but to no avail, and they become very cynical. It's okay to be a little skeptical, but the moment you become too cynical, yes, you feel like either giving up or walking away. So skepticism is okay, but have that aspiration, have that positive attitude. No, things can change, but it may take time, and we do need to build this network of change agents who can support one another in the cross-boundary work and in the creation of a more dynamic, diverse culture that allows for the expression of leadership not only from the top, but at all different levels.
Right. Well, speaking of change, leading change is also a big part of your book. And affecting change, as you say, is always one of the most difficult things to do. What's the role of the leader and how can he effectively lead change, he or she?
Yeah, it's don't want to overwhelm a system by doing too much too soon. You have to pace the work of change. Orchestrate a process of what we call adaptive work. Adaptations in parts of the organization. And that requires a lot of experimentation. Experimentation in parts of the organization. So you've got these change projects. And each kind of intervention or project or experiment will generate more data about what's needed to respond to the more complex challenge of being a successful organization, a global organization. So too often what you see in organizations, you get a new CEO, and CEOs change rapidly around the world. You know, after 3 years, it's almost the average tenure. So the board gets rid of them, appoints somebody else, and they start all over again. And that CEO comes in with this big, bold vision that they're going to change everything, and they never quite deliver because they're trying to do too much with a very skeptical, even cynical group of employees. And they overwhelm the system, and the people just wait it out until the next guy comes along. So a more paced strategic process is critical, and engagement at all levels is important. Recently, I worked with an organization. It was a large bank in Australia. The top management team, when I came in, had already been for 6 months isolated on the 45th floor of their office complex, working with McKinsey and developing a new strategy for change and development and increasing market share. And I said, what the heck are you doing? You're so isolated and disconnected from what's going on out in the field, and you should get out and start engaging people. And the CEO said, I don't want anybody engaging anybody until we can all speak with one voice. I said, it's not about speaking with one voice. It's about listening with open ears. Mm-hmm. Because the people who have a piece of the solution are not big consulting firm that you're paying a lot of money to. It's your own employees who are working on the front lines of these challenges. So get out and start engaging. Seems almost obvious to anybody who has an appreciation for good management and leadership, but it was disturbing to see that even in this day and age, people were still disconnected from that, and they were preoccupied with technical data of change and failing to realize that any kind of change is essentially a cultural change. So engagement at all levels is critical in order to generate a shared understanding of the challenge and a shared aspiration that makes sense, and then to include, you know, the raw, hard data that McKinsey is so good at generating in that process can be very powerful. You know, change, be strategic, experiment, and with experimentation means it's going to be a lot of failure. That's transcending boundaries. All change work is transcending boundaries. It's pushing boundaries. It's busting boundaries. And as you do that, there's going to be error, mistakes, and breakdowns along the way. But error, mistakes, and breakdowns are the source of data. So rather than blame people, fire people, get rid of people, there's the opportunity to learn what happened there. What did we learn, or what do we now see about this problem that we didn't understand before? And given that knowledge, we can include that now in our problem-solving, creative, strategic work and move along at a much faster rate. So if there's no tolerance for uncertainty, experimentation, and breakdown, how in the world are you able to generate any kind of breakthrough? So leadership work is managing the breakdown to generate the learning that's needed for advancing at a more rapid pace.
All right. Well, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much, Maya. Good talking with you.
Dr. Dean Williams, author of the book Leadership for a Fractured World, How to Cross Boundaries, Build Bridges, and Lead Change. This has been Resource Center. I'm Maya Tan for BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.